This is Michael Gibbons, Chief Judge, Nevada Court of Appeals in the Carson City Supreme Court courtroom. I'm joined today by Judge Jerry Tao and Judge Bonnie Bulla in the Las Vegas Supreme Court courtroom. And we have counsel here. We have our next case is 80-804-99 COA, Sullivan versus Sullivan. Harvey Sullivan versus Leslie Sullivan. And this is the time set for oral argument. This case is in the pro bono program. We have Mr. Stewart here representing the appellant, Harvey Sullivan, Mr. Stewart from Hutchison and Steffen. We just had Mr. Wall here on the last argument, but I assume you, the two of you are in two different locations. Can you hear me okay, Mr. Stewart?
I can. Can you hear me all right?
All right. You're a little bit soft. If you were either turn up the volume or get a little closer to the microphone. And then also for the respondent, Leslie Sullivan, I see a conference room, Jones and Labello, and Mr. Jones.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And my associate, Elizabeth Fleming, is also present.
Okay. I'm sorry. What is her name?
Elizabeth Fleming.
Okay.
Bar number 12964.
Thank you. All right. You're sitting at a table. Is there a microphone near you?
I actually will probably be addressing the court a little bit closer to the microphone, which is above the television set.
All right. Actually, the volume appears to be the same whether you're sitting or standing.
I can turn it up as loud as it can be, and I also can probably talk at a slightly louder voice.
All right. And I believe Ms. Fleming has argued in front of us before.
She has, Your Honor.
Yes. Are you going to divide the time?
No, Your Honor. I'll be handling the argument.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Judge Tao, do you have any introductory comments? Judge Tao, can you hear me? I can't.
Can you hear me?
Okay. Oh, there.
Can you hear me?
Now I can. Now I can. Maybe it was muted.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, that's, you know, an example of, you know, sometimes we get little glitches here. But I wanted to thank all of you for working with our IT people to get this set up. We've been doing arguments this way for a couple months now, and it looks like with the pace of the vaccine, we're probably going to be doing this for at least a few, if not several more months. I know it's not ideal. I'd rather, you know, have you guys all here, but this is the best we can do. And we just had an argument with Mike Wall from your firm, and we had a little bit of glitch with the video, but it looks like it's fixed now. Hopefully there won't be anything going awry during this argument, but I mean, this is the new normal now. But Mr. Stewart, thank you for your firm taking this case pro bono. We just had the other pro bono case with Mr. Wall. One of the problems of the court system is there are more cases than there are lawyers in town willing to take them. And it's always great when any lawyer steps up, but especially a firm of your quality and experience. I'm sure your client appreciates it. I know that we all appreciate it because we get better briefing, better arguments, and we wish that that every lawyer in town would take some cases through the pro bono program. We're really looking forward to the argument. And if there are any issues with you being able to hear us, please, you know, like raise your hand or something. We, you know, hopefully that won't be necessary, but we've had to do it once or twice before. But, you know, that's the way it is nowadays.
Okay. Thank you, Judge Tao. Judge Bulla, do you have any opening comments?
Welcome. We're very pleased that you're all here. We look forward to your arguments. Judge Tao and I are in the Las Vegas courtroom. Although we are socially distanced, we still have our masks on. Hopefully you'll be able to hear us without difficulty, but if you do have a problem understanding a question, please let us know and we'll restate it. But we are very much looking forward to your arguments today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Judge Bulla. Mr. Stewart, do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. And if I end a little earlier than that, unlikely, I'll reserve the balance of that.
All right, thank you very much. This case has some interesting issues regarding the procedure, no choice of law, jurisdiction, and then other issues in the case too. So it should make for an interesting argument. You can proceed, Mr. Stewart.
Thank you, Chief Judge Givens, and may it please the court. Daniel Stewart on behalf of appellant. I appreciate the time to be here. Given the virtual nature of this this argument, I did want to provide just a little bit of a roadmap at the beginning. Although we briefed a few issues in our brief for appeal, I'm going to focus today on the jurisdictional arguments and the choice of law arguments. If possible, of course, take questions in any way on any subject that comes up. To begin with the jurisdictional argument, whether a court has subject matter jurisdiction to even hear a case is the first and most foundational question in all of litigation. The plaintiff must prove that such jurisdiction exists, that he or she has brought the right claims in the right place. The court also has an independent and continuing duty to determine subject matter jurisdiction. The door to subject matter jurisdiction has a single gatekeeper, and that's the law. If subject matter jurisdiction does not exist, neither the parties nor the court can ignore it, consent to it, or waive it. In fact, subject matter jurisdiction is so important that it can be brought up at any time during the litigation, and as the Valley case shows, sometimes even after the litigation is resolved. In Nevada for divorce actions, which this was, the statutes provide the subject matter jurisdiction. NRS 125.020 says that no court has jurisdiction to grant a divorce unless the plaintiff or defendant has been a resident of the state for a period of not less than 6 weeks preceding the commencement of the action. So 6 weeks before the filing of the complaint for divorce. NRS 10.155 then defines residence. It's the place where the person was physically present. And that's been further fleshed out in case law, including the Valley case, the Aldebaugh case, and Fleming. Essentially, for divorce cases, there's two major questions for deciding or determining residence for the purposes of subject matter jurisdiction. First is the physical presence, actual physical presence, and the second is the intent to make Nevada the residence. There is an exception for travel. Once you've become a resident, you can leave. As long as you have the intent to come back and as long as you've already establish a residency in the first place. According to case law, it must be permanent and continuous. Now, NRS 54010 says that in all cases where subject matter jurisdiction depends on the resident, the court has the duty to require corroboration. Here, in this case, Mr. Sullivan disputed that the Nevada courts were the appropriate jurisdiction, filed a motion to dismiss on those very grounds. Before they got into the court on that motion to dismiss, there were quite a few undisputed facts that at least made it a question of whether jurisdiction exists. And to my knowledge, those facts were never controverted throughout the course of this case. First, the parties had five houses, at least in some courts, lived in Arizona, Wisconsin, Panama, and Nevis in the Caribbean. She rented an apartment in Nevada that was appears to be too small for her medical conditions. Didn't have a doctor in Nevada, despite serious medical conditions. She was a citizen, dual citizen of Nevis and the United States. She had two passports. Out of the state for, admittedly, for all or most of the 6 weeks prior to the filing of the complaint, traveling all over the country and, quite frankly, all over the world. She signed her complaint for divorce from Wisconsin. They had an Arizona prenuptial agreement that was to be governed by Arizona law. She had registered to vote, but it appears that the first vote she cast was in the 2018 general election that occurred not only after she filed her complaint for divorce, but after Mr. Sullivan had filed his motion to dismiss. To prove her residency, she came into court with the only documentary evidence were her 2017 tax returns. Apparently it was undisputed that she also had a Nevada real ID, although I didn't see a copy of the ID in the records, nor were the documents provided choose to get that ID. And again, registering to vote. I didn't see any indication of when that occurred, how that occurred, and when she voted. She did provide, at the end of all the papers that her attorney's filed, she did provide a declaration saying that she agreed with all the arguments, or that she, all the facts in there were stated to the best of her knowledge. And then lastly, there was no resident witness. She did not provide a resident witness at this case. Now, Mr. Sullivan disputed much of those facts, particularly the intent to stay or to make Nevada the resident. He attempted to make those points in the evidence in the motion to dismiss hearing and was denied the opportunity to speak. He was represented by counsel, but he did try to speak. And then he asked for an evidentiary hearing on those issues, which was denied. Ultimately, the court found that subject matter jurisdiction existed because of the taxes, the real ID, and the voting. And I've already said that they argued that the voting itself, given that it occurred after the claim for divorce, can't be offered as proof. He declined the evidentiary hearing on the ground that Mr. Sullivan failed to offer or provide any offer of proof. Well, we dispute that. Mr. Sullivan was trying to offer proof. That's why he wanted to have the evidentiary hearing. That's why he wanted to speak. But also, it wasn't his duty to prove anything. It was his. It was the plaintiff's duty to prove. Now, there was also an argument that his jurisdictional motion to dismiss failed because he didn't offer another jurisdiction in which this could be heard. There was, if you look at the transcript, mentioned possibly Panama. Mr. Sullivan would have corrected that had he had a chance to speak, and he's always maintained that Arizona is the proper location. So, from the outset, plaintiff didn't prove proper subject matter jurisdiction, nor did the court make any real effort to corroborate subject matter jurisdiction. And given that, the case essentially stops at that point. At a minimum, Mr. Sullivan would still like a remand for an evidentiary hearing.
Well, let me ask you this, because an evidentiary hearing, you know, you don't get an evidentiary hearing just because you want one. You have to show there's an analog to the relationship between a summary judgment motion and a trial. The request for a summary judgment, or request for an evidentiary hearing, you have to show that something's in dispute. It's not a discovery mechanism. You can't just say, well, you know, I just want one to see what the evidence is. She's presented at least, I know the facts, there's kind of a jumble of facts. There's evidence of ties to Wisconsin. There's some evidence of ties to Nevada. But she's at least made an initial prima facie case of connection to Nevada and intent to return. So what's he genuinely going to dispute here, as opposed to just sort of saying, I want to see what there is?
Well, Carvinga, I don't know that he needs the hearing to see anything. I think he's seen essentially all that's been offered on this issue. What he would offer at that evidentiary hearing is proof that there was never any intent to make Nevada the residence, that it was simply used as a tax shelter in order to avoid Arizona taxes, and that the divorce here was entirely improper. He would use the evidentiary hearing to prove that, not necessarily ask for additional proof from the plaintiff. I don't know.
So what specific evidence would he introduce? Because again, to use a loose analog to a Rule 56 motion, right? She's got some prima facie evidence. If he presents nothing, right? If it's all undisputed, then she wins because she's met her burden of proof. If he's contesting something, then the court has to weigh out, does it meet the standard of proof? So, I mean, just sitting here saying, well, he's going to dispute it, what's he going to do?
Well, I want to be careful too, because since none of that was actually offered into the record, I don't necessarily, I want to make sure that...
No, I understand that, but at least for purposes of whether you get a hearing, which is a chance to offer a record, if she's at least made a prima facie proffer, right? Again, we're using a summary, just an analog. What's his proffer that anything's in dispute that the court at a hearing would then weigh against each other?
Correct. Appreciate the question. His proffer would be being able to show that there really was never any time spent in Nevada at all. That the apartment was rarely used. In fact, it didn't even have internet connection or utilities or power. And that, again, he would show through both documents and his own testimony that the only reason Nevada was included in their lives or was a part of their lives was for an issue for her to avoid taxes. And these are the types of things that he would offer at the evidentiary hearing.
Mr. Stewart, let me make sure that I understand the facts correctly. Didn't your client and Ms. Sullivan move to Nevada together in 2016? Wasn't that part of what was established before the court?
Your Honor, be careful in the way I answer this, but the that is when they established, that is essentially when they started the process for the, in order to deal with the taxes. My client would dispute that they ever moved to Nevada. It was essentially a process of paperwork that was created, a checklist, if you will, so that they could, Ms. Sullivan, who has significant assets, so that she could avoid Arizona income taxes. So, I don't, yes, 2016 was when they took efforts to make Nevada the residence for the purpose of taxes. But again, he would dispute that they ever physically moved here or that this became a residence for the purpose of taxes.
Where does your client reside now?
He currently resides in Nevada. There was a dispute over whether he could return to the Nevis property. He can't return to the Panama property as the divorce decree. The Nevis property is supposed to be sold and the assets split, and he has not felt comfortable returning to the Nevis property yet. But the Nevis in the Caribbean is what he would consider his home, if given, the chance, to move anywhere he wanted.
So let me ask you a question, and this is a little bit of a this may be a little bit of a supposition. Let's say for one second that everything you said is correct and this is just a scam to get this divorce in Nevada. Why? What's the benefit of getting divorced here? I understand you want to, a lot of people want residence here for tax purposes, but what advantage does this give her in getting divorced here? Why does it matter here versus Arizona versus Wisconsin versus any other places where they have, where this could be, the domicile?
Appreciate the question. In fact, that actually leads right into the choice of law argument. Again, to reiterate that the first establishment in Nevada, a residence, was for tax purposes. For divorce purposes, the law on gifts, on businesses, and so forth is better for the plaintiff than the Arizona law. Mr. Sullivan's contention would be that had this case been decided in Arizona, under Arizona law, the outcome would have been quite different. In fact, you could look at the prenuptial agreement itself, and Ms. Sullivan has sought the benefits and the protections in any way.
Yeah, but why does that matter? Because if, you know, if their prenuptial agreement is in effect, even if it's in a Nevada court, right, they agreed to apply Arizona law. So what's the benefit?
I think the benefit was essentially what occurred here, is that by having it occur in Nevada, the default. And I know that the Ms. Sullivan's position is that the prenup agreements have nothing to do with substantive law, only procedural stuff. By having it in Nevada, Nevada substantive law would trump at that point, regardless of the choice of law provision in that case.
Mr. Stewart, how would it be different? Judge Tao raises a good point. If the property was distributed in Nevada or under Arizona law versus Nevada law, how would that have been beneficial? Why should that matter?
Okay. The property or the divorce was decided on all cases under Nevada law. In fact, there's no evidence that Arizona law was considered at all. In Arizona, things like gifts, such as if someone's added to a title, under Arizona law, even if it was initially separate property, it's presumed that it was made a gift. Same with business organizations. Mr. Sullivan, Ms. Sullivan formed an organization or a business called Leslie. Arizona law would likely give him the benefit of that, even if her separate property had formed that corporation in the first place. He was added to the title of things like the cars and other property, and it's his contention that under Arizona law, he would have had a claim, at least a claim as a donative gift, for half those items. But because it was first brought into Nevada then Nevada substantive law was applied top to bottom.
All right, Mr. Stewart, you better stop if you want to save any time.
Better stop. I'm under 20 seconds.
All right. Well, we'll probably back it up to give you a little bit more than that because of the questions from the court. But nonetheless, you needed to stop before it was all gone. All right, we'll switch to the respondent's side of the case. As you've heard, the only issues discussed so far are the subject matter jurisdiction and the choice of law. And under choice of law, the related question of even if the court was wrong on the choice, would the result be any different? So I don't know, Mr. Jones, if you have other issues you want to discuss, but that's where we are so far.
I guess the question I have for the court is whether or not it would like me to address the other issues that were briefed that are not going to be argued here today.
Okay. Well, I think Mr. Stewart very correctly identified the major issues in this case, so I would stick with those unless you have time to go beyond that.
Okay, I'm generally fairly succinct, so I may have time to comment on those. The questions that the court asked, and I apologize, may it please the court, John Jones appearing on behalf of the respondent. The questions asked by the court, I think, are the right questions. I do have a little bit of an advantage of being trial counsel that Mr. Stewart does not have. So I don't take issue with the fact that perhaps some of his statements might have taken liberty with the record. But from the standpoint of the difference between Nevada, I'm going to address the Nevada law, Arizona law first. Arizona is a community property state. I think what Mr. Stewart was trying to enunciate is Nevada has 125.150, which allows the court, gives the court discretion, doesn't require the court to reimburse a spouse's contribution to separate property, or to joint tenancy property from their separate property. There's a specific statute that allows it. The argument was Arizona doesn't have an analogous statute. However, our Arizona case law does recognize the discretion of the court to give a party who contributed their separate property of reimbursement. Now, the irony of this issue is that the appellant, Mr. Sullivan, actually won that issue and the respondent lost that issue at trial. Our argument at trial, the single biggest asset that was at play was the Nevis home, which has a value of between $900,000 and $1 million. 100%, it's not disputed factually, that 100% of the money to purchase and refurbish the home came from Leslie's sole and separate property. So we were asking at the time of trial for a 125-150 reimbursement of whatever she contributed, and then if the house was sold, she would get that off the top and any proceeds would be equally divided, which would have been the appropriate application of 125-150. The trial court denied that request, found the home to be community property, ordered it to be sold, and the proceeds divided equally. Now, this goes back to the sort of underlying question of how would any of this be different? If all of the alleged grievances that the appellant has were agreed in his favor, would it be any different? First of all, the one fact that I think was left out in the argument on the issue of jurisdiction is the appellant had a Nevada Real ID ID. He was registered to vote in Nevada. So you had two Nevada residents appearing before the court, and one, in his motion to dismiss, he admits that he had a Nevada driver's license, and he was registered to vote in Nevada. He says that Leslie convinced him to do these things. And you're right, in 2016, that's when they set up Nevada as their domicile. And so from the standpoint of the case law, the Aldave case, Vail even, Moore versus Moore, these cases all stand for the proposition that once I establish that this is my domicile, this is where I'm residing, this is where I'm filing taxes from, this is where I'm voting, this is where I've proven to the Nevada government that I am a resident by getting a real ID, that I can then travel the entire world 365 days a year as long as my intention is to come back to Nevada. I mean, under the argument forwarded by the appellant, if the parties went on a year-long cruise, one of those world cruises that went to every port on the planet, and because of the interactions on that cruise, they decided to get a divorce when they got back, there would be no place for them to file. That's sort of the problem with the argument made by the appellant here. And on the issue of residences or homes that my client owned, the parties didn't own the Wisconsin home. My client owned it. My client owned the Arizona home before marriage. The only thing that was purchased during the marriage with my client's separate property was the Nevis home. And again, I've never had a jurisdictional challenge where someone came before the court with a motion to dismiss, confirmed that they themselves had a Nevada driver's license and were registered to vote in Nevada, but asked that the case be dismissed and then didn't give the court the better venue, the better forum. He never even argued that Arizona was a more appropriate forum in his motion. He just asked to have this case dismissed, and I guess the court was left with the idea that my client's not entitled to have her divorce. And there was one misrepresentation made. Actually, I'm going to say it's a representation that's not supported by the record, was that she wasn't physically present for a significant period of time prior to the filing. While under the case law, that's not a requirement, as long as she has established this as her residence and domicile, the fact remains she had a family emergency. It's why she was in Wisconsin. She had already met with her lawyer in Nevada and then had to travel there when we were trying to file and get him served because we had a service window issue. So that representation that she wasn't here for a long period of time in the 6 weeks was not supported by anything in the record. However,
so let me ask you this. You're right that residence doesn't require continual presence in the state. As you said, you can literally be here a day and then travel the world as long as you intend to return. The key element here is intent. But given that intent is such a squishy, subjective thing, why is it appropriate for the district court to decide this thing on, and this is the inverse of the question I asked Mr. Stewart, on proffers rather than actually get everybody under oath and see what their intent is?
Well, at the hearing on the motion to dismiss, the court took evidence. The order denying the motion to dismiss specifically says the court, having considered the evidence presented at the hearing, the argument, the pleadings, etc., because there was testimony by my client. The court specifically asked her questions. The court specifically reviewed her real ID driver's license. And
right, but I gather the piece that Mr. Stewart thinks he's missing is the court can ask, but he didn't. I think what he's saying is he didn't get it. Well, and not him, because he wasn't even there at the trial, but his client didn't get a chance to cross-examine and see exactly. I gather that's what he's saying is the piece that's missing between what happened here versus a full evidentiary hearing.
Well, and actually, at the motion to dismiss hearing, he was represented by counsel, and counsel could have cross-examined my client, and counsel did make argument on his behalf. The idea that he was precluded from speaking was more about the judge saying, sir, you have competent counsel, you should allow your attorney to speak unless I ask you a specific question. It was more along those lines that he didn't get to speak as was argued by counsel. But at the end of the day, the court found that evidence. And I believe the court found, although it's not specifically in the findings, but when you file your motion to dismiss, admitting that you have a Nevada driver's license and are registered to vote, two of the most crucial factors under any Aldave analysis, I don't know that the court had much that it needed to inquire about because you've had two people standing before it who had availed themselves of the forum. These parties intentionally availed themselves of Nevada rights, Nevada law, and the Nevada courts, both of them, not just one of them. So this isn't I think there's a legal advantage to filing here. It was, this is where we have to file. This is where the divorce should take place. And The evidence established in the record also proves that the Arizona property was a rental and the Nevis property was a rental. We know that because the appellant absconded with the rent money at the beginning of the case, and rather than adjudicate that at the initial hearing, that on his request for temporary relief, the court said, you know what, sir, you can keep that and use that to pay your attorney's fees. But then he failed to pay his attorney and then proceeded to trial many months later in proper person. So from that perspective, I also think that when you then pursue affirmative relief in the Nevada courts, after his motion to dismiss was denied, he filed a motion for exclusive possession of the Nevis property. He asked for temporary support. He asked for attorney's fees. And I understand that under our case law, a request for attorney's fees does not preclude him from later asserting a jurisdictional defect. But at the end of the day, when this court recognized that both parties were residents of Clark County, Nevada, based upon their driver's licenses, the rental, the lease that they entered into here in Nevada, their voter registration, I don't believe the inquiry needed to go any further. Now,
Mr. Jones, what about the... All right, I think you've covered that jurisdiction point. I think you concluded on that. What about on the choice of law? Is there really any doubt that the premarital agreement was signed in Arizona and the parties were there at the time? There's property, there's business, there's a lot of things happening in Arizona. I mean, is any doubt about Arizona was connected to the premarital agreement?
There is no doubt whatsoever, Your Honor. However, the issue, and as someone who does nothing but practice family law, I know it very well because it's been an issue in many, many cases. The Uniform Premarital Agreement Act entered or enacted by the state of Nevada and the same one that was enacted by the state of Arizona, their language is nearly identical. But what the UPAA specifically sets forth are the things that can be in a premarital agreement. It gives a list of 9 items that are allowed to be in there. And the one item that it says is allowed to be in there is choice of law as it pertains to construction and interpretation. It does not allow, in fact, the Uniform Premarital Agreement Act would preclude a provision that said no matter where the parties end up residing, no matter what jurisdiction has, jurisdiction over a divorce action, the substantive law of China would apply to this premarital agreement or to their divorce. So from the standpoint of what the UPAA says in both jurisdictions, you could not have an agreement to have substantive law of Arizona applied in your Nevada case.
Don't Nevada statutes allow for the use of the law of the other state as long as it doesn't contravene Nevada public policy?
Yes, it could. You certainly could apply it, but the court wasn't required to apply it, and no request to apply Nevada or Arizona law was made at the time of trial. But more importantly, the only argument is that the prenuptial agreement, and this was an issue throughout the case, because from a settlement standpoint, we were very far apart because I expected the court to give my client separate property reimbursement under NRS 125.150, and the other lawyer at the time believed that Arizona law would be applied on a substantive basis, based upon the language of the prenup alone. Meaning, if he had a claim, and just so we're clear, the property in Arizona was my client's sole and separate property. There was never a dispute on that. He did not make a claim for that. So the fact that an LLC was formed in Arizona at some point would not have, unless the court wanted to address just the LLC under Arizona law, but I don't believe there was a dispute over whether or not there'd be a difference between Nevada law or LLC issue. So those issues were never, the idea that there'd be a difference in the application of substantive law was never raised, but more importantly, He won the only issue that it was relevant for. The only issue for which there was a divergence between Nevada and Arizona law was whether was the fact that there was a statute that allowed the court, gave the court discretion to give my client a separate property reimbursement, and we lost that issue. Now, this is one of those cases where you're shocked that the person who's appealing actually appealed, because my client was the client that was the party who ended up basically losing $500,000 of her separate property by virtue of the court declining to exercise its discretion under 125.150.
Mr. Jones, is that in fact what happened? The court looked at that statute and decided not to exercise its discretion, as opposed to saying Arizona law doesn't allow this, therefore you can't even get out of the starting gate.
The courts, I don't have the transcript in front of me, but I believe that Judge Thompson said, well, she transferred it into joint tenancy for a reason, and that reason was testified by my client to be to establish dual residency in Nevis, because in Nevis, properties carry with it a residency component. Certain properties, if you buy a specific property, you can then obtain dual citizenship. I used residency when I meant citizenship. So that was the testimony for the reason, and the judge specifically made a finding that, well, she did this to obtain citizenship for both parties so they could travel the world under a non-U.S. passport. That was the reasoning testified to by my client as to why this property was purchased. And since that was the reason she did it, I'm going to say that it's community property.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Jones, very much. Mr. Jones went over time there, so Mr. Stewart, we're going to put you up to 1.5 minutes.
We can't hear you, Mr. Stewart. You might be muted.
There we go. Sorry about that. I'll be very quick here, just responding to some of the things that came up. First, as to the allegations about the record and her physical presence before the filing of the complaint, I was basing that solely on the record itself that says it was travel to Baltimore, San Diego, Wisconsin, and so forth. Second, I would encourage the court to actually look at the hearing transcript on the motion to dismiss. I do not believe there was any testimony offered or even included from Ms. Sullivan in that. So I don't know where the idea that there was testimony from her in that. I do not see her testifying. In fact, I don't even know from the transcript whether she was physically present at the hearing itself. Third, regarding the Arizona prenup, no, the court did not do any analysis on whether Arizona law applied or not, and that was the problem. And as the court is well aware, parties can use choice of law for all sorts of provisions. In fact, they list them in the statute itself, including any other matter. I do think, although the time is short, Arizona, there may be other issues, like whether it's a no-fault divorce state or not. But I would just simply say that there was a choice of law provision in this prenup, and the way this case unfolded, it was as if there was none at all. My client got zero benefit from that. We'd ask that this court add it in.
Wait, Mr. Stewart, what about the main point that Mr. Jones just made? The 125.150 could have benefited Ms. Sullivan, and the court declined to exercise its discretion and allow any sort of reimbursement.
That is correct. Although from the transcript itself, my understanding was that the argument was that the entire Nevis property be declared hers as well. But I don't know that, again, from the transcript itself, that there was any finding that this was either under Nevada law or under Arizona law. What there was this idea that essentially the way I understood the court, it said, look, you can't give him the half the property for the purpose of these citizenship issues and take the benefit of that and then claim that he was not entitled to half the property. And I got to be clear, too, he's only entitled to half of the proceeds of the property if the property sells, not half the property itself.
All right. Thank you very much. That concludes the argument on this matter, so it will stand submitted to the court for a written decision at a later point in time. The court thanks again Mr. Stewart and his entire law firm, Hutchison & Steffen, for taking this case on pro bono. And excellent work, Mr. Stewart. Thanks again. And also Jones & Labella, the usual good job from that firm. It's a privilege to have a high-quality attorneys at our arguments, even on what some might consider not as significant, being a pro bono case, but we consider it very significant. And Ms. Fleming, you didn't get to say anything. Do you want to say hello? Yeah. All right, thank you. All right, Judge Todd, do you have any concluding?
I get the glory.
All right. Judge Todd, do you have any concluding comments?
No, just to thank you both. There's a lot going on in this case, and it's always a pleasure to have two really good firms with two really good lawyers on this. That's, as you practice family law, it's not always the case where both sides are capable lawyers. And then you add in the fact that it's a pro bono case. It's not always the case that you get two top quality law firms, two of the best law firms in town on it. And so this was a real pleasure to have both high powered law firms on this case, and we really appreciate it.
Judge Bola?
Thank you both so much. Enjoyed the arguments, and I appreciate you participating via video conference and being very gracious about the current situation we're in. And thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Thank you. And Mr. Stewart, I asked Mr. Wall after the last argument if he was aware that in the Washoe County Bar Association monthly publication, the writ, the issue that came out a couple of days ago had a front page story about Justice Steffen and his passing, his life and career. Were you aware of that?
I was not, Your Honor. I've been buried in the papers, but I'm going to go. I've got a lot of free time for the next couple hours, so I'm going to go give it a look.
Okay. Written by Judge David Hardy from Reno, and he likes to do profiles and stories about judges from the past, but this was the present, and a very moving tribute. All right, we'll be in recess. Thank you.